beautiful day to sit inside and talk physics. So I would feel sorry for you, except we are actually getting into stuff that I think is really quite cool. And the last time we looked at this set of equations, and this set of equations embodies everything that we've done up to this point. In fact, within this is a complete description of electromagnetism, if you don't include quantum mechanics, which we'll get to in time. We have Gauss's law, which we're used to. We have the magnetic equivalent of Gauss's law, which is what you end up with because there is no thing like a single magnetic charge where field lines are, where it's a source or a sink of field lines. And if you don't have that when you evaluate the centigrade, you get zero. So this is a fundamental description of the reality that we have. But Ampere's law, and the way that we have seen it, is this. Just these two, just the left-hand term on the right-hand side. This integral of J dot dA is just another way to write I enclosed, where it's the current density going through the area that is subtended by the curve that you're talking about over here. And then last time we introduced this right-hand term, which was what was introduced by James Clerk Maxwell, and really was the last piece that fell in place to pull these equations together. And then we have Faraday's law, which you've seen. This was basically the induction that we've been talking about recently. Now, what you'll notice is that these two equations are really tightly coupled, and they have a time dependence in them. So if I have effectively a changing electric field, I'm going to have a B field, and if I have a changing B field, I'll have an E field. So you get this coupling where an electric field can induce a magnetic field and a magnetic field can induce an electric field. And that leads to some absolutely spectacular stuff, which we're going to talk about now. I want to spend just a moment and show you a different way of writing the same equation. I could take the next 40 minutes and take these equations and from them extract these equations. I'm not expecting you to recognize pieces of this. This is this upside down del is a strange sort of vector that we call a vector operator that includes derivatives in a vector sort of sense. And when you take the dot product of this weird vector with a vector, it's called the divergence And then if you take the cross product of it with a vector field, it's called curl. This actually gives you an indication of how much the field diverges from a point or as it goes into a sink of a point. The curl is a measure of how much the vector field actually circulates about a given point. The information here and the information here are identical. I'm only really writing this up here because if you're walking across campus and you see a physics geek friend of yours with a t-shirt on, it'll say, let there be light, and then they'll usually have these equations and not those equations, so now you know what they are. They're basically equivalent. If it were important for this class, I would make this transformation for you, and from this form, it's relatively easy to extract the field the wave equations and to get the behavior of, say, electromagnetic waves, which is about what we're about to do, except I'm not going to derive it for you, okay, because I could do it, I'd put a few of you to sleep, some of you would think it's totally cool. It's not worth our time because we have a lot of other topics to do. So if this were just an electromagnetism course, that's what I would do, but we're also supposed to do optics and a lot of modern physics, so it's a big survey course. So with apologies, magic happens. So from those equations are always true. So they embody classical electromagnetism. So unless you are doing something, except for a very few phenomena, which we'll talk about, this describes electromagnetic things. So it's very powerful. But that said, if you stare at those equations, I don't think you get a real intuitive picture of what's going on. So the way to get a better picture of some of the neat things that are enclosed in those equations, I want to go from sort of those general equations to a very specific case. And I want to look at what those equations give you in this specific case. So if I wanted to take an hour, I would extract those differential equations. From those, I would rip them apart, and then we would go to a specific boundary condition, which is we have a source of electromagnetic waves and we're very, very far away. And under those conditions, I could take those equations that we would get and rip them into pieces, and we would find these solutions. Okay? So I don't think I have made this completely plausible, but I hope you believe me. If it's something that really interests you, I can certainly point you to material where that kind of stuff is done. But it is not important for what we're doing in this class. However, to understand, to get the intuition, what's going to come out of it is important, because it's the intuition I want you to carry away about electromagnetic waves and what they really are. So what we find, if we look at a phenomenon, so what happens if we take these two equations and we go to a region where there is no current, so this piece is gone, and if one looks carefully at this, the essence of it is that you have coupled time-dependent differential equations. You can separate them out, and it turns out that what you'll get is, well, so what you have is, if I have a changing electric field, it will induce a changing B field. If I have a changing B field, it induces a changing E field. And that just self-couples and propagates outward. If you take these and you rip them apart into an equation just for the E that you have, or just for the B that you have, what you would find is you get an equation that looks very much, well, is identical in form to the equations you've seen way back when you did waves. There was sort of a, when you saw waves, I don't know that you really, I don't know how much this would have stuck at the time, but you'll have a second derivative spatial thing, and that's equal to some second derivative time thing, and it's called the wave equation. And when you look at solutions to that, you get these harmonic solutions. So from this wave equation, if you ask, if I take a string and I do this, and you look at the wave shape that propagates down the string, it satisfies that equation. When you rip these two apart, you find that both E and B individually satisfy wave equations. But they're coupled together. So it is the E that creates the B and the B that creates the E. So it's happening at the same time. Okay? So if we look at what comes out of Maxwell's equations, then I have a source that's very far away. If you think of something that is a source of energy that's, that energy is going to go out isotropically, okay? That's complicated, because you need spherical harmonics or something to really understand mathematically how that goes. But if we go very, very far away, right, this circle of energy, by the time it gets to us, just looks like a plane. Life becomes much simpler. So when I say far away, I mean we're so far away that the light that's coming out doesn't look like it's going out spherically, but looks like it's a plane wave coming right at us. So the mathematics is much simpler. And I said that the E and B individually satisfy wave equations, which means we can sort of pull out the solutions that we had for wave equations earlier. And I'm going to make an approximation. I'm going to constrain the problem in, I guess, in a mathematical language with no loss of generality. I'm going to constrain the problem. That is, I'm going to say this wave that's coming is going to have its electric field oriented in a certain direction. I have the freedom. There's no constraint coming out of Maxwell's equations that says how the electric field that's coming at me that is part of this wave, whatever it is oriented. And I'm just saying, I'm going to orient it in a specific direction just so I have some place to start. So what we're going to say is that the electric field is going to be oriented along the y direction here, and that the electric field, which is along the y, will be a function of position and time. Imagine if it were a string, okay? When I say, if I look at the displacement of a string, if I have a string here, and I'm doing this so that the wave is doing that along the string, okay? Then the displacement is a function of this direction, which I'm calling y. I'll do it like this. Okay, so now the displacement of the string is along the y direction, but if you notice, the time dependence and the shape dependence is going like this along the x direction. Okay, so that's really what we're talking about. Except I guess I'm doing it this way, so it's traveling like that. So we have E along the Y by choice. By choosing the coordinate system, I know that it is a function at a given position. The electric field is a function of time. And if I were to freeze time, the electric field would be a function of space, just like a string, the motion on a string. It satisfies a wave equation, so it will have some amplitude, which I'll call E0y, and it'll satisfy a harmonic. And it will be a traveling wave. So that's where you get the kx minus omega t. So if this is a harmonic wave, then we have a spatial part, which gives its what the function is a function of where you are in position, and the k here is equal to 2 pi over lambda, where lambda is the wavelength, or the distance over which this function repeats itself, the cosine function. So if k is 2 pi over lambda, then this function will repeat in space every lambda in distance, because you'll basically have another integral times 2 pi. The time dependence, this is an omega that times time. Omega is equal to 2 pi over the period of the wave. Okay, so what do I mean by that? String? Somebody standing over there doing this with the string. Okay? So what's coming down the string are these waves. They're traveling, all right, at fixed speed. It's like a cosine curve that's moving along the speed of the wave. You into this? All right? Visualize it in your head. All right, so this is going. If I were to take the string and just put a little piece of tape right here, and you look at that piece of tape, as the wave goes through, the tape would just do this. Right? The time over which it goes through one full motion is the period of that wave. It's simple harmonic motion. If you look at that point, it just does simple harmonic motion up and down as this wave goes through. Okay? That piece of string doesn't go anywhere. It's not the wave. It's just the medium that is getting displaced. The wave is this shape that's traveling. Okay? This is the equation for that traveling shape. It has both a spatial and time dependence. If I freeze time, forget the phi for a moment. If I freeze time, it's just cosine kx. That means every time I go a distance of one wavelength, I'll come back to the same point as I walk along the shape of the wave. K is known as the wave number. The wavelength is the spatial period of the wave. So all this in principle you know. I'm just trying to remind you. You may want to go back and look at the wave chapters and stuff that you're supposed to have done with Professor Jordan. Now, let's say I go to position x equals 0 and t equals 0. The wave start somewhere. I could start with my hand up here and do this, starting at t equals 0. I could start it here at t equals 0. I could start it down here at t equals 0. That's the initial condition. Whatever that is, that's what determines phi. It's just a constant that basically defines how things are starting. We call that the phase angle.
Or the phase. Okay,
so Maxwell's equations tell us that electric field satisfies a wave equation. I make a choice that I say the electric field is going to be in a certain direction, oscillating in a certain direction. I make a choice, I say I'll call it a cosine instead of a cosine. It doesn't matter because I can change that with phi. Phi is just a constant, so all I've done is said I have a wave. Therefore, it has an amplitude, it has a spatial frequency, it has a time frequency. And that is the equation for a traveling wave. So once I decide it's a wave, that's all just, you can write it right there, okay? That's just like what you've done with string. Okay, now, Maxwell gives us this coupling between E and B. That's a very essential and important part of it. Because although I can get a wave equation for B as well, and I could write down an equation for B that is just like that, because E and B are coupled together in the same physical system, it turns out that once I choose E, there are constraints on what B can be. Okay? So if that is E, then B happens to be the following. And there are some particular things I'm saying when I write it this way. So let me just write it and then we'll go through it. Then B is along the Z. That is, the electric field and the magnetic field are at right angles to each other. The argument of this cosine and the argument of that cosine, and the fact that they're both cosines, tells you that E and B are exactly in phase. So if E is a vector that's sort of doing this in time as the wave goes by, B is doing that. This is, Maxwell got this before John Travolta was ever born. So these things go in phase, and they're at right angles to one another.
John Travolta?
Dude. Look up Google John Travolta. I'm probably dating myself more than I am you. The king of disco. Greece. Yeah. That's okay. I know almost no cultural references. Certainly not within the last 10 years. So. If this is an amplitude E0y, the B field has an amplitude E0y with this quantity multiplying. This K over omega
is equal to 2 pi over lambda over 2 pi over period, which is equal to actually, I want to write that the other way. I guess we'll do it that way. K over omega is 2 pi over lambda over 2 pi over period. The wave goes a distance lambda in a period t. So this is equal to t over lambda. That's equal to 1 over the speed with which this thing propagates. It goes a distance lambda in a distance time. So the speed is going to be lambda over t. And when you look at these waves in a vacuum and you calculate the speed with which they propagate, you calculate, using Maxwell's equations flat out, the value you get is 1 over the square root of mu 0 times epsilon naught. If you numerically put that in your calculator, you'll find that that is the speed of light. Okay? Which is amazing if you think about it. All right, that's one of the clues that this is the essence of light. All right. So this says if I have a certain amplitude for the E field, then I have constrained what B is, and B is actually the amplitude of the E field divided by the speed of light. So the magnitude of the magnetic field along the Z direction is 1 over C times the magnitude of the electric field in the Y direction at any given moment, and they're in phase. Okay. So this was when I really started designing these things that I keep showing you little things along the way. The set of ones for electromagnetic waves are sort of the hardest things to draw, and we'll do a little bit of it. This is what I'm trying to paint for you, okay? In this case, E is along the Y here, and B is along the Z, so of course it's not consistent with what I just did on the board, but that's okay. Just trying to keep you on your toes. So in this case, the wave is traveling this direction. What you see are electric field vectors and magnetic field vectors that are oscillating. If I look at just this time, they are oscillating in time according to a cosine. And if I were to freeze time, you see that they lay out a cosine curve spatially. So I can freeze time, right? I can do something that's sort of cool here. I can show you this plane. And you can look and see what's happening in that plane. Okay? Now, one thing that is hard with this visualization is remember, these are plane waves. So what do I mean by that? What you see here is not something like an envelope containing the electric field. This is not a photon. We're not saying the P word yet. Okay, this is not confined along the plane. This vector, this orange vector, represents the electric field at every point in this yellow plane at that instant. And that yellow plane is infinite in all directions. It's a big plane wave coming at you. The green represents the the green is the electric field, the orange is the magnetic field, okay? But what you see is that field is oscillating everywhere in that plane, all right? And if I freeze time, and I move the plane, what you see is that spatially I have different E and B as I walk along that field, okay? I can
can change the frequency of the light. If I go to a lower frequency, it propagates with the same speed, but the oscillation happens with a bigger period. If I go to a high frequency, the oscillation's happening with a short period. Okay? What your eye perceives as color is this frequency. If the light is bluer, it is a higher frequency light. If it is redder, it's a lower frequency light. If it's a lower frequency than that, your eye doesn't see it at all. Call it infrared or radio or something. It's much higher if your eye doesn't see it. Call it ultraviolet or X-ray or gamma ray. These are all exactly the same thing. They only vary in frequency. So we call them generically electromagnetic waves. If you're being loose with the term, you can call it all light. But usually when people talk about light, they're sort of talking about just that region of the electromagnetic spectrum that the human eye is able to see. Okay? Any questions on what I'm trying to do here? So there's something that is absolutely spectacularly, amazingly cool about this. If I have a wave on a string, and I do this, you can see the wave. The string is displacing it. The string forms the wave. The wave is traveling along the string. Right? I get to the other end that as the string moves, it can do work, so it carries energy. If I have a pond, and I just take my hand at the edge of the water, and I just do this, I can create a nice water wave in the water. It's a displacement in the water. It can carry energy. It can do work. It travels with a certain speed, which is governed by the nature of the water. If I had a pond of honey, I could do the same thing, but it's not going to travel as fast because honey is viscous. What is this traveling? So, when Maxwell came up with this stuff, people understood waves very, very well. If I understand waves, and this clearly fits wave equations, then something has to do the waving. Now the problem is, where's that something? Light seems to travel through nothing. So people made up a material. They called it ether. It's ethereal because you're not aware of it. And what they said was the ether basically is waving, that these waves, these electric and magnetic fields, somehow travel in this ether. And if that's true, then we should be able to detect our motion with respect to the ether. Let me put it to you this way. If I have a pond of water and I do this, and you imagine the waves and the water traveling, if you're standing right here, they will travel with a certain velocity. That is the velocity of propagation on the water. Now, suppose you make the same measurement. Here go the waves, and now I'm walking.
Same speed as the waves.
They're not moving with respect to me. Right? So, if electromagnetic things are traveling in the ether, then in principle, one should be able to look at them at different speeds and detect your relative motion with respect to the medium. Another way to say it is that if they're traveling in this medium, I ought to be able to run as fast as light and see it while it's standing still. Okay? That's Newtonian mechanics. That's just like everything that we've done up till now. If I'm walking at 4 miles per hour. If I now step on a moving sidewalk that's going 2 miles per hour, I'm now looking to you like I'm 6 miles per hour. The weirdest thing happens with light. If you look at light, that doesn't happen. It doesn't matter what your point of view is, it looks like it's going the same speed. So it's a little bit of a weird thing. Light does not travel, apparently, in a medium called ether. It's a very special wave. It's different from any of the other waves. All the other waves that we've discussed, or that you discussed last semester, travel in a medium. The string is displaced, the water molecules are displaced, that's the form is moving in. This is really special because you get this really bizarre coupled interplay between E and B. It's traveling because I'm inducing an E, which induces a B, which induces an E, which induces a B, and it just propagates outward at the speed of light. It doesn't need a medium. It works in a vacuum. Why do you care? If you walk outside today, are you happy that the sun is shining? Do you feel the warmth of the sun? There's a whole crap load of vacuum between us and the sun. But that light reaches us. Because light can travel through a vacuum. That's not true for a string wave. It only travels on a string. So these waves are fabulous. They're because of this sort of self-induction that you have between the E's and the B's, this coupling, you get this phenomenal wave that can travel. And as we're about to see, it can carry energy, it can carry momentum. It's really a fabulous phenomenon. Now I want you to think back for a moment. When we first started talking about electric fields, where did that come from? I know there's a force. What is that force? I don't know. I'm going to see if it mathematically sort of makes sense to say that this thing creates a condition in space over here. I'll call it the electric field where I have a force. We totally pulled that out of thin air. It's a calculational convenience, is all it is. We did the same thing with magnetic fields. Totally invented them. And now, are you a believer? These things may be real. I mean, light really works, and light has nothing to do with charge or current loops. Once that light is going, it just does its thing. And it's very real. It carries energy, it can give you sunburn, it grows corn. I mean, it's seriously stuff. Right? How cool is that? It's really neat stuff. So, I don't know. I think it's absolutely cool. And physics is filled with some of these little things where it's like, holy crap, that's real. When quarks were first made, quarks are little sub-particles that are inside of protons and neutrons. And those were invented sort of in the same way. It's a calculational tool to explain the fact that we have particles with different charges and masses. And this sort of worked. And then, lo and behold, people did experiments where they could actually scatter off things. They realized there was substructure inside protons and neutrons. And it actually was just like you had quarks. So you have quarks. I mean, it's sort of. So there's a lot of examples like that. These sort of neat theoretical tools that turn out to be described and turn out to actually be real. It's sort of neat. At any rate, so here we are. Here's my attempt to draw it. It's a pain to draw, so I went ahead and took advantage of the fact that I haven't drawn elsewhere. So what we have in this case, this now corresponds with what we had earlier. E is along the Y here. B is oscillating along. I'm sorry, E is along the X. Z, geez, that doesn't correspond to what we had, does it?
Y, Z, X.
Okay, sorry. I just changed the coordinates a little bit to keep you on your toes. Anyway, so in this case, we choose E to be going along the Y, and B is at right angles to it along the Z. And this amplitude is related to that amplitude by dividing by C. And you have same phases. They oscillate in X and T. E and B vectors are always perpendicular to each other, and you'll note that they are transverse. They oscillate transversely to the propagation of the wave. This is one of those things that if you're looking at the plane waves because the source is way, way over there, that's what you see. If you're a lot closer to the source, things aren't quite that simple. Your intuition should be that they are transverse waves. There's a relationship between the amplitudes. They are in phase and they have a certain speed. And note, in this case, if the wave is propagating that way,
E cross B gives you the direction of propagation.
So these are the things that come out of Maxwell's equation. Is basically a shortwave radio. What it's really doing is it is something that is sending, it's oscillating the voltage between these two wires, sinusoidal, with a frequency that we put it in a region of radio frequency. So basically you can think of this as sending a current just oscillating back and forth like that. Okay? If I have a current that's doing that, then I know I'm basically doing that because I have an oscillating electric field. And I know that that gives me a magnetic field that oscillates like this and then oscillates like that with the same frequency. Alright? So this is generating electromagnetic waves. They are penetrating your very being. But you'll be okay. So, I have a choice. I have defined the electric field to be this way because I've been generating the wire like that. Here, I have nothing but a metal bar across a little light bulb. That's all this is. Okay? If I put it at right angles to this, the electric field that is in this space here isn't doing anything very exciting. Okay? Because the wires are oriented this way, so nothing else is happening. But look at what happens if I rotate it like that. If I rotate it more, it goes away. So we have an electric field in space that is oriented like so. And when these wires are oriented such that you can form currents along that direction, you form currents and you actually get power output in that lane. Have you seen anything so cool as that? Try to explain to your friends why we saw a light bulb go off today and it was the coolest thing I think I've ever seen. There you are. The fact that the electric field has an orientation and the way in which it's oriented is what we call polarization. So in this case, we're generating an electromagnetic wave of a certain frequency that has the electric field polarized in this direction. Okay? And we'll talk more about polarization as we go. But look at that. Not only are electric fields and magnetic fields real, they can be polarized, they carry energy. That's the other thing. Where's the energy? That light is actually going off, right? There's evidence that electromagnetic waves transmit energy because it is coming from that.
Does it mean the bolt on when the wire is parallel or perpendicular? It's hard to see.
Your bolt is on when the wire is oriented this way, so it's along the electric field.
Okay.
The electric field is oriented. So what's happening is the electric field vector is oscillating back and forth here. And when this wire is oriented so the electric field is oscillating this way, it's creating current. And if I'm at right angles to that, then it goes away.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so as I mentioned, there's nothing special about visible light except that you can see it. And it's this tiny little boring little sliver of the great electromagnetic spectrum. And you can have waves as big as the universe in terms of their wavelength, or so small. There's no real limit either direction. It's more a matter of can you create them or not. When we get to quantum mechanics, we'll find that there is the energy that is carried in the quanta of light, as we'll get to it, goes as the frequency. So the quanta of light, that is when this light interacts with matter, it has much, much more energy than what we would have over here. So there's a lot of richness both in terms of the wavelength, the energy carried, and etc. But these are all basically just different flavors of the same thing. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is to examine energy flow in an electromagnetic wave. So let's imagine that I have some coordinate system with a y this way, z that way, x that way, and let's imagine that we have an electric field this direction, and if we have that, then we will have, if it's a traveling electromagnetic wave, it will give us a magnetic field this way. So that's at a fixed moment in that point in space. What I'd like to do is to imagine sort of a box in space. So we have sort of this, let's imagine a thin plane in space, a thin little box-like plane in space. And we now have this wave passing through that point of space, that little volume of space. So let's assume that this volume of space that I'm choosing here has a thickness, which I'll call dx. And let's give it, for completeness, let's say that this side and the other side have an area which is equal to A. And we'll say that we have a source of light that's very far away. And when we have that, what we were just describing a moment ago is called a plane wave. So we're going to say that we have an electromagnetic . So when we have such a wave, it means that the solutions and the things I was just describing, the intuition that we just developed, fits this problem. Now, one of the things we've seen earlier, which at the time I got excited about, and maybe you didn't know why, we found that the electric field has an energy density. And the magnetic field also has an energy density.
that depends on the square of the electric energy density depends on the square of the electric field amplitude and the square of the electric field magnitude at that moment. And the magnetic field depends on the square of the magnetic field magnitude. So if we want to know, as this wave is passing through our box, if we want to know how much energy is in that box, then the differential energy, I call it differential because we're only taking a tiny little sliver, okay, is going to be equal to the electric field density of the wave that is in the box at that moment plus the magnetic field density of the wave that is in the box at the moment times the volume of the box. So this is going to be UE plus UB times A times dx. You good with that? Okay. So that means that du is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times E squared plus 1 over 2 mu 0 times B squared times A times dx. Earlier I showed you that C is equal to 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught, C being the speed of propagation of this wave as it goes through. And we also found that E, the magnitude, at any given moment in an electromagnetic wave, the magnitudes of E and B are related by this quantity C. So E is equal to C times B. So those you've actually saw on the previous page. And if I just rewrite, use these things, you can rewrite that epsilon naught is equal to 1 over mu naught times C squared. So why do I do that? I just want to rewrite the E's and the B's a little bit. So I can use those three things, and I can say that du is equal to 1 over 2 mu naught C squared times E C B. So basically I am rewriting for the left-hand term one of these E's in terms of B, so that'd be CB, and I'm rewriting this epsilon naught over 2 using this thing. Plus, the other one becomes 1 over 2 mu naught times B E over C. So I'm rewriting one of the B's here in terms of E using this. And this whole thing is multiplied by A times dx. So what I'd like to do is to now wait for a time dt. The power that flows through the box in a time dt, du dt, is the power. And that will be like divide this by the area. Power through the box is going to be the power per area, okay? Because the box is only so big. If I take the C and I put it over here, that's power times the speed. So that basically will give me it's dx over dt. If I take the C each of these is 1 over c, and I put that there as dx over dt. The dx is canceled, and I have the du over dt times area. So I then divide out the area. So I take this, and I've gotten rid of the c and the area and the dx, and this is equal to the magnitude of E times the magnitude of B times mu zero. So the amount of energy that passes through the box, or the energy per unit area per time that you have passing, is this magnitude of E times magnitude of B times mu zero. If you're only given E or you're only given B, you can rewrite in terms of this, if you wish. This is energy per meter squared. This is watts per meter squared. And this is what we call the intensity of the EM wave. The energy per time per meter squared. So if I know the energy output of the sun, I can actually calculate the theoretical limit of how much corn I can produce on an acre of land. Because if I know the energy output of the sun, I know how much energy is passing through this square meter per unit time. And that much energy, if you had perfect photosynthesis, et cetera, which as you well know isn't the case, if you had perfect, that amount of energy would be the limit as to what you could produce in terms of whatever it is you want to do. Okay, so this is a pretty powerful thing. But this is intensity. So this is the brightness of the lamp or whatever it is that you're seeing. The brightness that you would perceive. Do you recall when we did, or when you did sound waves, the power per meter squared was the loudness, right? That's sound intensity. Here we have the brightness, the light intensity. The wave is actually flowing. It has a direction through the box. That direction is E cross B in terms of direction. The intensity is E times B over mu naught. So we make up a vector. We call it S. It is the vector energy flow, called the pointing vector, not spelled like you might imagine. And we define that as E cross B, so you get the direction of the wave flow divided by mu. If you look at that, the magnitude of this is the same as the intensity. So the pointing vector is the intensity, but it contains direction. As you saw, the electromagnetic wave is such that the E and the B are growing and they're in phase, so they're zero, and then they grow, they go opposite directions, they have maximal magnitude, they go back to zero, then they grow again, maximal magnitude, back to zero. So if I look at any thin box in space, if I look at a plane in space and I ask, what is the intensity of the electromagnetic wave as a function of time, it's oscillating. I have no intensity, then I get a maximal intensity, then I have no intensity. So you sort of have that. But it's happening really fast. You're going to do some very simple calculations of the velocity of electromagnetic waves and what are the oscillation periods. And these things oscillate really fast, you know, 10 to the 15 times per second. So you don't perceive these intensity oscillations because your instrument averages over that. And generally, that's what's important. If I'm growing corn, I don't care about that oscillation and intensity. What I care about is how much energy is there per year or something like that. So it's a very different thing. So what's usually more important than the instantaneous pointing vector is the time average.
So often we'll write that like this, or sometimes like this, with a bar that's not a vector, just close enough to a vector to make it seem like it might be a vector and be confusing. If we do that, if we fix the position, so we're looking at a fixed point in space, let's just make that x equals 0, then what we have is that the electric field is going as some E0 times, you know, a sine or a cosine, I'll use a sine this time, omega t, and B goes as E0 over C times the sine of omega t. It shouldn't bother you that I use a sine instead of a cosine here, right? They're just harmonic functions, and they just vary by phase. So in that case, S goes as 1 over mu 0 times C. And it's, remember, E times B. So that goes as sine squared omega t. And if I time average a harmonic function, square of a harmonic function, it goes to 1/2. So what that means is that the time average intensity, or pointing vector, is equal to the amplitude of E times the amplitude of B, that is the biggest it can be, the maximal intensity sort of thing, divided by 2 mu 0 times C. This is instantaneous E and B, okay? And that E and B can be big and small. It goes within the envelope of its amplitude in the wave. Here I've converted it, I time average, and now it's in terms of the amplitudes. So that would be the intensity, the average intensity in some given time. Okay? Any questions? Let's imagine for a moment that I have a positive charge sitting right at the origin. And let's say that we have an electromagnetic wave passing, a plane wave passing through, going in this direction. And we'll say at this moment, just for us to have something to talk about, we'll let the electric field be in that direction. I could ask you now, what is the direction of the magnetic field? If the wave is traveling in that direction, the wave goes in the direction that is E cross B, which means if E is that way, B would have to be out toward you. So B is like so. Now, if we just sort of forget for a moment that the wave is traveling, but just think about it for a moment. Here's a charge. There's an electric field on the charge, so I know the charge will begin to move. The charge moves, it moves that way. If I have a charge that's moving in that direction in a magnetic field that's that way, B cross B gives me a force going that way. So what this says is that if I have a charge, or think matter, an electromagnetic wave should exert a force. As weird as that may seem.
Force is equal to a change in momentum with respect to time, and that goes as qv times b,
which goes as Q times V is the distance per unit time. B is E over C in terms of magnitude. So this and this is a force. This is a distance per unit time. So this thing, at least in this hand-waving way, is equal to 1 over C times the amount of work that is done by the wave per unit time.
Force times distance is basically a work per unit time, and then I have the 1 over C. So you would sort of call this dimensional analysis to sort of understand what may be going on. The force is going as 1 over C times the differential work with respect to time.
That's dP over dt.
So if I sort of get rid of the dTs, I have dP.
So that means that dP goes as d work over C, which is the same thing as energy over C. Or a way to say it is that the momentum that is carried by this electromagnetic wave is equal to its energy divided by C. I admit this may feel a little bit hand-wavy, but it basically works. This may seem really strange because I haven't said anything about this wave having mass, but it has momentum. It can exert a force. So the force is dP over dt, which is 1 over C times the energy per unit time.
So I'm basically taking the force is 1 over C times the energy per time. And I'm going to multiply the energy by area and divide by area.
If I have an electromagnetic wave, the energy per time per area is what we've defined as the intensity, or S. So this is S per C times the area. If you recall, pressure is equal to force per unit area, which for an electromagnetic wave is S over C. And this is something which we call radiation pressure.
Take a big sheet of aluminized mylar, very light mylar stuff, and I put it out in outer space and turn it toward the sun like a big mirror. The light from the sun will exert a force on it and it will accelerate. It's called a solar sail. You can sail on light waves just like you do in the mirror.
same sort of thing, but the pressure that's exerted goes as the energy divided by C. So as you get very far away from the star, it doesn't work out so well. There's a much more important reason why this is so important, actually. And that has to do with how stars work. Stars are born from interstellar gas. Most of the universe is just filled with hydrogen gas. And I'm going to fast forward through a lot of the really interesting stuff that happens at the start. But let's imagine you now have this big, big region of space filled with hydrogen gas. And let's say that you have some sort of perturbation that causes some of these hydrogen molecules to sort of be a variations in density. When that happens, some of them will begin to clump together a little because, as small as it is, there's a gravitational force between them. They're hydrogen atoms, they're neutral, so there is no electromagnetic repulsion between them. There's nothing out there but gravity that slowly wins. So what happens is you will take this cloud of gas and slowly it will begin to collapse to a point. Now, most of you have had enough chemistry. Depending on how it's taught, you may not have understood what was happening here. If you adiabatically compress a gas, it gets hot. I saw some heads go. Another way to think about it is if I'm pumping up a bicycle tire, feel the nozzle after you do that. It's hot. Or if you take compressed gas like hairspray or paint spray and you let it out, the nozzle gets cold because you're adiabatically decompressing. Adiabatic means there's no time for heat to flow. Okay? So if I take a gas out in space and I adiabatically compress it, it gets hot. As it gets hot, hot is infrared radiation. It's hot. It's emitting radiation. We're going to talk about black body radiation. Basically, if I take something and I heat it up, it emits radiation with a very characteristic set of frequencies called the black body radiation. So this begins to glow as it gets hot. That energy gets bled off into space, but it also exerts pressure outward. And that keeps this whole thing from collapsing super fast. Slowly, more of the heat bleeds out, and it continues to collapse. Eventually, it collapses enough that it gets hot enough in the center of it that you have enough energy for the nuclei that are in this thing, the hydrogen molecules, to be moving so fast. That's what you mean when you say it's hot, right? Degrees of... The energy per degree of freedom is 1/2 kT, something like that, right? So as it gets hotter, you have more energy per degree of freedom, which means it's moving, you have kinetic energy, and eventually you have enough that you overcome the Coulomb repulsion and you get things close enough that what we call the strong nuclear force kicks in and they actually combine into a nucleus. That's what's called nuclear fusion. When you do that, it releases a lot of energy. So all of a sudden, at the core of the star, you begin to basically have thermonuclear bombs going off, which produce a lot of energy, which pushes the thing out. Gravity is still pulling in. You have some sort of weirdness, but eventually it settles down. And that's what a star is, a big gas cloud with nuclear bombs going off in the center of it all the time, the nuclear core, pushing outward, stabilizing it against gravity, and pulling inward. And if the ball of gas is big enough, that can last for some 10 billion years or more. That's what our sun is. Okay, that's... So this radiation pressure, you know, in a sense, you're never going to have to worry about it. You don't feel it, whatever. But it is absolutely essential to the stability of stars. It's the thing that holds them up. So it's really cool stuff. So this turns out to be very important. This would be the radiation pressure if you have full absorption, I believe. Just like the momentum transfer is different if you catch the basketball somebody throws it at you or you bounce it off you. The momentum transfer to you is twice as much if you bounce it, because you're taking the thing that's coming with a certain momentum and reversing it to make the momentum go that way. The same is true with radiation pressure. If you have a surface that is entirely black to the light, it absorbs the light. You'll get radiation pressure, which is this. If I use aluminized mylar, the radiation comes in and gets reflected. You have a change in momentum, which is twice this. So you'll have to take that into account. And that will give you some annoying problem set problems that force you to do that. But that's the origin of it. It's nothing more than the same classical change in momentum that you get due to reflection. All right. How are you doing with this? Any questions? All right. Where we're going next, the course is going to change dramatically as of basically right now. I could take Maxwell's equations, these wave equations that we've just learned, and I could look at what happens when these waves are incident on a plane of glass, for example. And when you do that, you in fact find that they'll bend in terms of their direction, called refraction. Things like that happen. So you can take Maxwell's equations and you can derive the laws of geometrical optics that you use to create lenses and things like that. So when I tell you that all this stuff we've been learning about, this is light, it's totally light, and you can even use it to derive all that we know about light and its interactions with matter and optics and things like that. I'm not going to derive that stuff for you. I'll make a little bit of it, hopefully a little bit plausible, but we're going to take a break now, in a sense, and we're just going to start doing geometric optics for a little while. Then we're going to start looking at what happens under certain circumstances. We'll look at quantum mechanics and nuclear physics and atomic physics. So now the course is going to change a lot. Up until now, we've really seriously been building on everything we've done. It's really hard to do what we're doing. I mean, you have to remember what pressure was in order to think about this stuff. Okay? Now the course is going to go into more of a survey mode. Many students are much more comfortable with the class a little bit from here on out, in part because you've seen in chemistry, you've seen some of the quantum mechanical stuff and atomic things, right? You've seen orbitals and things like that. So a lot of that will look familiar. What I hope to do is give you a sense of where it actually comes from, because they're not too good in that in chemistry. So we'll do that. In a sense, for many of you, each of these topics will be a lot easier than Gauss's law. As almost anything in life is easier than Gauss's law when you first did it, okay? There's a problem, though. It is April. I'm supposed to fit an entire semester with the modern physics in this semester. I can't do that, obviously. But it is going to be like a chapter per class for a while. We're going to do a lot of pretty quick topics. It's going to be too fast. I know that, but we're supposed to do a lot of stuff here. There'll be some holes. You'll have to fill them if you're going to take MCATs or something. If you're doing it just out of interest, you know enough to go fill your holes. I mean, it's not a problem. But I will try to do a lot of it. I have some responsibility to do that. But it will be a little bit like taking sips of water from a fire hydrant. So please try not to get too far behind now. The stuff, I think, is easier. But if you look the other way, there's going to be a lot of water having to happen to you. So just watch out. Thank you.
All right. Go enjoy this beautiful day.